the best subject we always get to talk about, but it's much needed, especially in churches. And I'm going to read you a definition of intimate partner violence. It's a pattern of coercive behavior used by one person to control and subordinate another in an intimate relationship. These behaviors include physical, sexual, psychological, and economic abuse. Tactics of coercion, terrorism, degradation, exploitation, and violence are used to engender fear in the victim in order to enforce compliance. What are some things that jumped out at you when you see that?
Mm-hmm. What would your definition of terrorism be then?
Well, you know, it probably depends on the application. In this day and age, when you think of terrorism, you're thinking of, you know, 9/11 type stuff. I get why it's there, but that's.
Yeah. People in an abusive relationship live in a constant state of fear, terror. I mean, you think about. The Munich Games, remember way back then, the Israeli athletes were attacked by a group of terrorists. And it's interesting because these athletes are thousands of miles away from their home. They're at a peaceful event. And yet when somebody with a mask on comes to the door, they all know to jump out the windows. And one knows to block the door. And so to live in that constant fear, you never leave it. No matter where you are, no matter how safe you feel, you are always in a constant state of fear, terror.
I was thinking about the economic abuse and just the power that folks have over others in controlling if they work, where they work, how they spend their money, if their money is joint or if it's you work and then give it to me, and just the crippling effect that can be on a family, especially if there's children involved as well, just thinking about the lack of needs being met for the kids as well.
So remember that. Later we're going to talk about barriers to why people don't leave. It's the number one barrier.
Yeah.
I think going along with that, how our society, I don't want to say encouraged that, but it wasn't until the 70s that women could even have their own checking account, right? Mm-hmm. And I know that not all intimate partner abuse happens. Females are not the only victim. It can be the other way. But I do know statistically more women than men, and that our society set up some certain things that allowed it to perpetuate and almost encouraged it by not allowing women to have financial freedom. And so there are so many of these things that people don't think about as abuse. And the financial aspect is huge.
It is. And you had a good point. Men are abused. But I work with mainly women, and in the setting with the spiritual, we find that because churches have been the big main ones not believing women, or trying to put something back together that shouldn't be. But yeah, thank you for bringing that up, because I always get that question, and I'm like, I tend to work on this side, and we try to talk about it spiritually, so yeah. Any others?
What?
You're going to go again.
Well, yeah, but I was going to.
I think the term engender fear is curious. Mm-hmm. To engender fear, I think it's just a curious way of saying create fear. Is there? Can you go into that a little bit, maybe, using the word engender?
So the batter or the abuser, ultimately they want you. I want you afraid of me, and that's it. And it's when guys go through the batter intervention program. There's a point when they come to the realization that my family's afraid of me, but they have to be prepared through the group and through the weeks of work to undo their attitude that the face-to-face thing is my family's afraid of me, that breaks my heart. And so now they're showing empathy, because batterers Batterers, abusers, manipulative people, they don't have empathy. They have it for themselves. They don't have compassion or empathy, which are key in who we are as humans, but is also the Christian faith. So there's that. They don't recognize that, you know, or they want you to be afraid, but they don't recognize that's a bad way to have a relationship. So it's just everything they do is about making you afraid. You do what I tell you because I want you afraid of me.
And yeah, that's the phrase I was on, because engendering is you're leaving those forces to then self-sustain within the victim. They mm-hmm. become their own prisoner, like yeah. they're guarding their own prison, mm-hmm. and they won't get out. And that's what that's what the other tools are meant to do,
yeah. yes.
to build it within so that you're, as the victim, you are constantly working against yourself. Yeah. Your will is broken. Yeah.
And that everyone else is against you, too. Yeah. I've found a lot of women... That's just their generalization for men, at all. Well, it's men. Men are we're going to watch you. It's yeah, and so I've had women tell me that they don't they don't trust any man, and I'm like, well, there's men who can trust, you know. But that's that whole like you just said. It's just this whole. It's an interesting dynamic. It is. But yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I do expert witnessing for attorneys in domestic violence cases. And the question I always get, whether the defense attorney's cross-examining, trying to disqualify me, or the judge or a jury, but the big question is, why don't they just leave? And so we start talking about, well, if they have a weapon, they're not going to leave. If it's a police officer who's abusive, usually the cop puts their gun on the table as a sign. The abusive cop puts a gun on the table to sign everybody, I have a weapon. You can watch the news and you can see incidents. We call them murder-suicide, but they're actually intimate partner homicide. If my partner leaves and I go murder her, that's intimate partner homicide. If I take my own life, that's intimate partner homicide, and then self-inflicted, whatever the term is. But the news doesn't use intimate partner homicide. But you can, if a person's in an abusive relationship, they can turn on the TV and, well, they had a restraining order against the guy, but the guy found him, you know. So there's fear, money. I don't have money. I can't provide for my kids. He's threatened me. Neighbors and friends will all rally around him, and you should go back. So the fear never goes away. I mean, when you leave, you still live in a constant state of fear, and that's a draw to go back. And I think, so why don't they just leave? Well, they really can't, you know. They don't just leave. I mean, it's a whole process we'll talk about later. But yeah.
Isn't there a lot of isolation too? Like they have like a lot of times had isolated their partner.
Yeah.
I was thinking about the isolation, like if it is a man-woman situation where the woman is being abused, they have isolated them from their support group too a lot of times, so they don't know who to reach out to because they haven't been able to cultivate relationships with other people. So even if the family has friends, their one side will not have, you know, they were, I cannot, words are hard right now. Anyway, like they have like taken their family and pushed them away so much that they don't feel comfortable connecting.
I also know women who I would not have known they were being abused either, because, again, it goes back to what Nolan said. They just learned, I stay in my box, I stay in my cage, and I'm okay. And they go about their business, but you see these odd little things that you go, that's not quite right. I actually worked with a woman a few years ago, and I finally put all the pieces together. It took me a while. And we went out with this couple, we knew something was not quite right. And I was on that. But, yeah, it took a long time. And she never actually walked about like somebody that was being harassed or hurt at home. So, yeah.
Yeah, the big thing I get from lawyers is I've never met a minister who defends the victims. And when I have conversations with a lot about, with the legal system, what happens is the offender manipulates their church. And so, and this is even true with the priests mm-hmm. Sexually abusing kids. They'll talk about, the priest and all of the people in the church there and the victim and their families. We see the same thing in domestic violence. There's the offender rallies people around them, And so the victim is pretty much by themselves and helpless and dependent on the system. And that's because they isolate. They manipulate not just the individual, but they manipulate all of us, which we, you know, offenders are very charming, kind people. They don't tell us the truth. So it's easy to get caught up on their side, you know.
Several people at my work have come out of domestic violence, which is why they do the work that we do. It always amazes me when they'll disclose that part of their lived experience. And yeah, it's very rarely is it the person that you, the stereotype that you think, the stereotype that the media portrays. That, I mean, yes, it does happen in poverty. Yes, it does happen. But it also happens in middle class. It also happens, you know, and in all class systems. And so I think that's the thing. And I always say the more money that a family has, the better doors they have on their closets. You know, and what I know is that, you know, people who maybe live below the poverty line, they don't always have doors on their closets, so it's easier to see things. But the more money you make, you spend money on your closet doors.
Right.
Somebody's going to spend money on
their
closet
doors. And the abuse is, I don't know the statistic on this, I probably should look it up, but I see more psychological abuse. I see physical abuse, but it's the psychological and the economic and all the other abuses that when you put them together is what are hurting people. And that's really hard because I'll have women go, well, I'm not being hit. I'm like, well, that's great. But you're being, you know, if you don't have the freedom to do any of that, you know, sexual assault in marriage or in a relationship is high. And that breaks my heart. When I started learning about that, I was like, wow, that's just, you know, and I'll have women, you know, argue with me. Well, no, I'm supposed to do that. And remember, I'm talking in a church setting. If I talk to women in that, well, that's, I'm supposed to do that. But did you want to? Was it forced on you? And so it's really, we just still, even in 2024, a lot of us think it's just physical and it's so much more. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And remember, the word is coercion. Persuasion is I give you evidence, I make a case, and you decide it on your own. Coercion is I do what I can to force you to choose my dependent. So, for instance, like Lori mentioned, sexual assault. When we've been on, and I've talked with college students, and when I say, I had sex with this guy, and then he went and apologized and confessed at chapel, and everybody felt bad for him, but I feel like this, you know, dirty person. And I'll ask, you know, was there consent? Well, I said no at first, but then this. Well, tell me what happened. Well, we were out in the car in the middle of nowhere. And so I'll start saying things like, could you have just walked away? No. Could you have gotten home by yourself? No. Was it dark? Yeah. Did you feel safe? No, he was up again. So what we start talking about is, so we would call that sexual assault because you were coerced. And then what we would say to the guy is that you weren't, you know, no did not mean no to you. That was not consent. Consent has to be safe. So coercion's a big word in this. How do I coerce you? How do I force you in to make a decision for me rather than persuasion? Here's my thoughts. You're free to make your own choice. And so when we start talking about coercion, then psychological, verbal, emotional becomes a big component in this. You know, well, I never hit him. No, but when you did this, you know, what did you say to her? Okay, you know, just like when I was a kid in a group, my dad never said, I'm going to spank you. He just grabbed his belt. You know, my brother and I were like, oh, stop. You know, because that was a sign, you know. Our boys just go, well, dad's gaining weight again, you know, he needs another bell, you know, type of thing. But yeah, go ahead. Because that's how we got started in this. We learned way, way, way back all this stuff.
So,
this is a segue to talk about how we got started on this.
Oh, okay, I thought you were going to.
I'm persuading you, sorry, I'm not.
So I realized this year in 2024, I've been doing this 30 years. But it started when I was in high school. My best friend, I don't tell this story a lot, and I also need to talk to her. My best friend in high school had a boyfriend who, he was physically abusive in high school, and I watched many times her being pulled out of the car by her hair. One time her mom and I witnessed it. And, you know, she just glossed it over. And I didn't know what it was. It was 1985, 84. And I was like, I don't know. I guess that's wrong. But I listened to her. She went to college. I got married. And she'd call me. And when she left college, he had financially abused her $100,000. Not college debt, but in cars and engagement rings and putting holes in their apartments. And just, it had added up over the 4 and 5 years they were together. And I just remember looking at Ron and I was like, I don't know what to do. I'd cry when I'd get off the phone. She was my best friend. I didn't know what to do. And we were living in Bon Terre, Missouri, this little town of 3,000 people. And it had the shelter. And the shelter had did five counties. And I didn't know much about it, but Ron went to a meeting, a ministerial alliance meeting in that little town, and the lady was there giving a talk. And she said, if any of you can, I will do free training if anybody can get a group of women. And I thought, well, all of our women at church are over 60. I don't know. I had 11 women show up. And Ron had all of these retired men go, how can we go clean up that shelter? It needed a new fence. It needed playground equipment. It was actually, they could stay at the shelter. So our church just started getting involved in this. And after the main training, I said, I really want to get know more about this. But it was quite spendy back then. It was $1,000 to go to their training. She said, if you just come volunteer, I'll train you. So I was trained that way, just feet, boots on the ground, just do it. You know, I learned everything at the shelter. And that's really stuck with me because that's grassroots, just like I'm going to find. She just put out a plea, and our little bitty church, who mainly retired people, said, we can do that. We can help. We know resources. Well, then, interestingly enough, they started going, wait a minute, that looked like my parents. That looked like, or there's somebody in my family that's doing this. And yet they started seeing that we all know somebody whose life's touched by some type of abuse. We a coworker, somebody, and we don't know what to do. And that became my ministry, is I just want to equip people. I do more of it, but I tell people, if somebody comes to you, especially in a church, if somebody walks in off the street and sits down by you, God must have picked you, and you need to know what to do. Doesn't mean you need to get them to a shelter, but you just need to listen, because most people don't believe or listen to these women. They don't believe their stories, because, you know, we go, really, that happened to you? Okay, you know, or I'm sorry, or what did you do? You know, that was always, well, what did you do? Did you provoke the situation? And so my last 30 years, that's what I've taught people, just be ready. Be ready. If you're at work and you realize something's not right, you can just sit down and listen. It's great if you can pull out a card and say, this place will help you. You know, we right now in Multnomah County, we have the Gateway Center. If they call the Gateway Center, they will get something done. They may have to call two times, may have to call three times, but the Gateway Center will help you. They do everything from restraining orders to money. We helped a lady 2 weeks ago be able to get in a place through the Gateway Center, through help walking with her. So just know your resources in your community, because then that probably spills over into just helping other people. But we brought the ministry out here. At Metro, they let us do a domestic violence conference the first year.
Yeah, every set.
And
every
I prayed over every seat I remember, and I just thought, just help people. And again, it became a... When Ron did his sermon, he had a line of women, and they were the older women at church, and they all said, oh, that was my husband who passed away. That was my dad. That was my, you know, developed a relationship with a guy who said, I really need you to help me. My dad's dead, but I need to know how to deal with this, you know. So we all see that. I'm not saying every, but somebody's life is touched by it. My family has dealt with it. So we all know somebody, because we know 1 in 4 women have been abused, and that's the ones that will admit it. I think it's higher. I think we've all experienced it as a female. That's why I work with females, because it just is a huge, the way that women are treated. So that is my ministry, and that's why I do this. The cycle of abuse is, you know, women will tell you this. There's calm in their house. It's going great. Then they can feel tension building. And then something happens, or nothing happens, and the storm erupts. It could be out of the blue. And that's why they call it the cycle of abuse. There's just this ongoing flow that people have.
Yeah, we look for patterns, because a person says, well, they've only hit me once. But when we start talking, there's a pattern. Maybe last time they didn't hit them, maybe they just got mad and, you know, said, you know, you're a bitch or whatever, you know, said things, or they threatened them. But there's that storm, that brewing, that people in this families will say, I could see it coming. You know, I knew how the evening was going to go when he hit the door, you know, from work, you know, or I knew they started saying a lot of things and threatening me, so I knew this was coming. And so what we do is we don't talk about the one-time incident. We talk about the pattern. You know? So like, for instance, if I'm in court, it's like, well, the police have only been called one time to this house. But we need to talk with the partner, because we don't know what's happened before that. Sometimes it escalates. And last time yelling at you didn't work, so now I'm going to use violence. And so we look for those patterns. The scary thing is living in the pattern creates this post-traumatic stress, this feeling that I'm going to do everything I can to avoid violence, or I'll stay and take the violence because he's been looking at my kids and I'm worried about my daughter, you see. So living in that, it creates this level of trauma. They talk about, eggshells? Mm-hmm. Walking on eggshells. This can be anything. This can also be outside of intimate partner violence, but typically this is what we see. So victims caught in this carry this trauma, this fear. They're always reacting. And we would get people who come to church and they would always apologize. And we're like, you don't have to apologize. You know, you have an opinion, we hear it. Yeah, okay, because they're not told that. You know, they're told it's your fault, so you need to apologize so that I don't get angry with you. And
violence doesn't happen every day, doesn't happen once a week, doesn't even happen once a month. We had a lady who has written a really good book. She was a lawyer. And her husband was a...
He's a lawyer, too.
He was a lawyer, too. Yeah. And she was in Chicago. She came and spoke out here for us. And we went to dinner, and she said, the one thing I want people to realize is I had 11 months of greatness, but if I was to get an award and he didn't, I hated to go home with him that night because he would hit me with that award because I was never to be better than him. And, you know, and she said, and then it was fine. And she said, I just thought, wow, he just has a lot of jealousy. Because she said nothing ever set him off the rest of the year. But if they went somewhere and she was recognized or called out for what she did, she said that was the turning point. And so she said that was really hard to realize. She stayed 10 years. She said, and finally somebody goes, well, that's abuse. And she said, oh, I didn't realize that. So it doesn't have to go, you know, daily or monthly. I worked with a woman in Newburgh. Her husband was a doctor. And she was a prisoner of her own home. She had locks on doors. She had 4 children. She was given a very small stipend to raise these kids. And she would say that. She goes, he didn't have to do anything after a while. I just knew I couldn't leave. She was in my group that I had a few years ago. And it was very eye-opening. When she did leave, it was very volatile. It was scary. I was scared for her. They lived in McMinnville area, McMinnville County, Yamhill County, that was it. And I thought, oh, she was going to go to court. And I thought, oh, it's over for her. She's not going to get anything. And the one side of the courtroom was filled with his church and all them supporting him, and he was a doctor. And her side had her mom and dad, a sibling, and me.
Yeah.
And I just thought, this is going to go bad. And I just kept worrying for her. And it took 5 minutes, and the judge ruled her. It was an astronomical. I was shocked. I was crying. And I remember the judge let me talk to him after. I said, why? I don't ever see this, especially in rural areas. He goes, because I went and got training for it. He goes, we don't know this. He goes, but we weren't trained for it. And he said, I went to training. I listened to my wife. And my wife said, all these women aren't lying. And so... that story always stands out, and she lets me tell that story because it's just, it's amazing to me. She's, you know, she was just prepared to walk away just to get out of the marriage. She wasn't prepared to get what she got, and she deserved it. But I wasn't either. But his whole church showed up, all of them. And it was just us on this side, like five people. And it was scary. And I knew some of the people at that church. And it made me sad. And I was actually asked to leave a meeting at that church because we were talking about abuse, and they didn't think it was necessary. So
the elders.
The elders asked me to leave.
We're not naming denominations, but you can figure it out.
Anyway, okay.
So, I'm getting old. My knees are hurting, so that's why I'm standing. I'm not signifying anything here. And I drank a lot of coffee, so I'm going to take a short break in a moment while you so this is the power and control wheel. We talk about this because if you see that abuse is not about anger, although anger is a weapon. Abuse is not about drugs and alcohol, although drugs and alcohol lower inhibitions and so forth. Abuse is about power and control over individuals. And if you can see this, Ezekiel had the wheel. Well, the domestic violence community has this wheel that we support. But these are the tactics typically that abusive individuals use, because the next question we're going to ask is how you see that, you know, working in a church. Because what we do, we work with agencies. Lori talked about Missouri, and when we left Missouri, the director said, I want you to know, she goes, Ron, you're the only minister from the Alliance that came to help over these 3 years. And she said, I hope you don't leave your abuse work in Missouri. And we said, no, we're going to take it with us to Portland. And so that's when I went to Metro, and we got involved in the community. And then Lori said, you should really go through the training like I went through if you're going to talk about this. And so the community trained me. And then the batter intervention guys said, well, if you're going to work with guys, you should go through the training. So they trained us. The Oregon attorneys, sexual assault said, come serve here. The sexual assault nurses said, come work with us. And I said, I could get fired for having these pictures on my computer. And they're like, yeah, don't worry about it. But, they were all generous in training us and working with us and partnering with us and sending people to us and saying, we can't work on the faith side, can you? In turn, we go and talk about faith-based domestic violence and what that's like. And we've been able to do that. So we have a wonderful relationship with our community. But the thing that our communities taught us that a lot of churches aren't teaching, and seminaries, graduate schools and so forth, is that power and control is the main issue in domestic violence. And if you think about it, using male privilege, well, that's a big one in a lot of churches. Even I've had doctoral students, females, who one was a Assemblies of God pastor, and she said, I know we have the reputation of being very progressive, but she said, the take with the women out of seminary is once you get a job, you need to gain 30 pounds and cut your hair short and wear longer dresses. Okay, that's not empowering women. But that is what I hear from my students, or students that would say, I've had a professor say, well, you're awfully sexually aggressive in how you ask questions. And I'm like, I'm not going to name schools, but that's not a Church of Christ school, but still. You hear that, and male privilege is a big one. I'm the man. I say this. It ends with me type of thing. The biggest one is minimizing, denying, and blaming. And I think over all the years that I've had to confront people over sin, I've rarely had a David moment. You know, when Nathan came to King David and told him the story, and David said, I've sinned. Now, David sat on that for quite a few years. So I think, that took a while. But I've rarely had an individual do that. It's always, it's somebody else's fault. It's not my fault. I'm not having an affair. I'm not using drugs. She's lying. My kids are lying. These people. So everybody's lying. Offenders will deny, well, the cops are unjust, and they have it out to get me, Black Lives Matter. Well, you're white. Yeah, but, it affects all of us. All lives matter. So these are things that you hear. They minimize it. It wasn't that bad. I didn't really do it. They're lying. It's their fault. It's your fault. You all are, you're a feminist. And I'm like, okay, but that's not the point. And so that's the biggest one for me, is the minimizing, denying, and blaming. But that's what they do. They have to go through a group where after a year, they finally admit to doing something wrong. and making amends to their victims. And this is true in alcohol, you know, drug recovery and so forth. But minimizing, denying, and blaming is huge. Isolation was one. Emotional abuse, intimidation. Sometimes when I've had to confront individuals, they'll puff their chest out and get, you know, and me, and I'll just say, we're not going to do that. And then they'll calm down and they'll try a different tactic. But that's a big one. You know, you're saying I'm lying? You know, why would you say I'm lying? Well, why are you upset? You know, and I said, wouldn't you be upset if you said I was lying? I said, well, I would probably say, well, why do you think that? You know, and then they'll sit down and say, why do you think that? Okay, here's why. But these are patterns that individuals use to get their way. And yes, women can be abusive to males. We know that. In same-sex relationships, females have been abusive to females. Males have been abusive to males. We know that power and control work at all different levels. But what we live in a country that tends to reward males for getting control over women. Or we live in a country, did I say that right, that where women are not valued and their opinion is not valued like we see with males. A prime example of that's wrestling. When I referee wrestling or coach with football, you know, somebody says, come on, ladies, let's get going. We need to work harder. It's like, we need to have a conversation about that. But that's already being taught to young males. So you got it. I'll take a short, or you want the next slide? Or, you want the next slide?
Yes.
Okay. So that's power and control. There we go.
So how would you guys describe the cycle of abuse? What do you see in that? Or any other questions that you might have right now? Or comments or concerns? Okay. Yeah.
Look over her shoulder from time to time. She lives in the southeast, Portland area. Where I used to work at Safeway. There are a lot of homeless people.
Ron left his mic on.
Yes, a lot of homeless people.
Yeah.
So she has allowed me to protect her.
Yeah, good.
I've been taking the bus, the 77, with her back to where the Goodwill is.
Right.
So I'll go with her, and then she takes the 73 back.
That's a good person. You're doing the right thing. I like that, Arthur.
Thank you.
Yep. Any others?
Perhaps more obvious in hindsight, but when you're in the cycle, it could be incredibly elusive.
Mm-hmm.
Even to the one being abused.
Right, right. Exactly. Yeah. Yep.
Another cycle we're seeing in my side of the world is domestic violence with children to parents.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
We have more adult children living at home than we
yes.
used to,
yeah.
and we're now going on cases of the children abusing the parents.
Yeah. That's
it's
good.
It's a new
yes.
world we're looking at opening up.
Thanks, Troy. Now it's something else I have to do. that's true.
Oh,
we're seeing the generation of people living at home as adults. That's a really good point.
I was going to say, is this on?
Yes, it's been on for a while.
No. You're kidding me.
I love you.
this is why when, you know, remember Earl Has to Die, Dixie Chicks, okay? When we increase the number of female shelters, the homicide rate against offenders dropped. Because there was a time when a lot of women were in prison because they had killed their offender, because that's the only way they could get out. So when we increase resources for females and increase resources for batterers, the male homicide rate dropped. So part of that with the children, you know, who've been abused by their parents, and then they become caretakers, they've not been able to get help. And what we want is we want people in an abusive relationship to get out, to get help, so that they can become healthy individuals. And that's not happening with, unfortunately, with kids.
Your mic's not working.
Okay, there we go.
Yes.
The focus on the power and control, and what's helpful is to think about, instead of those just being traits of an alpha male, it really is its own brand of narcissism. And helpful to realize that it's not coming from any point of strength. It is deeply ingrained insecurity. Mm-hmm. And so the need then becomes to control as a way. And so that's why it's not going to ever be solved by just compliance.
Yes.
And you have the cycle.
That's funny that you said that, because most of the perpetrators, I go, oh, that surprised me. And after a while, I started seeing that this is not about power or force. It's about narcissism. And yeah, that's so true. Yes.
Yeah, just to mention that, I'll have dissertation students who are going to write about America feminizing males. And I'll tell the directors at the seminary, I'll say, why are you giving me this? You know what I do? And they go, that's exactly why we're giving this to you. But when I meet with them, there are individuals, and so misogyny is a huge component in this issue. They're males that feel like, you know, women are getting ahead, women are getting too much permission, women are ruling the world, males are being oppressed. So there's this deep-seated misogyny that we see active in domestic violence. And it's a driving force. Pornography is huge in conditioning males to be abusive towards females. Number one place for people, for women survivors, are churches. They're the least equipped, although we've developed a cohort of ministers who this month are preaching on domestic violence. One of them is our own Kevin Reed, and we're finding that as we prepare more people to do lessons, it creates an environment in churches where people feel safe talking and sharing and feel accepted.
So it's important to click the QR code during the sermon.
Okay. Yep.
Because the two that have done it, we've found out that most people haven't heard a sermon about domestic violence. And so they're quick, easy questions, but it's been so exciting. And it's exciting to be a part of a church that wants to do, or at least knows what to do. You don't have to, it doesn't have to be your badge that you wear, but you know what to do if somebody needs help. And that's been exciting to me for East County especially.
Yeah. And so quickly, we're running out of time. What are some of the barriers for women in faith community? Marriage? What's our view of marriage? What's our view of divorce? You know, how do we feel? Malachi 2, the Lord says, I hate divorce. And it says, yeah, but finish that. And I hate a person who covers themselves with violence. So God hates violence. And, you know, so marriage is what holds a lot of children and parents. How do we feel about single adults? Think about how churches communicate single parenting. You know, kids are at high risk. No, they grow up in single parent homes and can be healthy. They're actually at risk being introduced to dysfunctional behavior. So if a person's married to an alcoholic and the kids are exposed to that alcoholic behavior, that's what we need to be concerned about, you see. Family, how do family feel about it? How does the church treat them, like a family or an outcast? Spirituality, so forth, community. Move on?
Yeah.
Move on. And how can we help? This is kind of the last slide. As Lori's listening.
Yeah, listening is the biggest part. Just to listen. Believe somebody. I'll believe you at face value. You don't have to explain to me. I will believe somebody. It's not up to me to be a detective. It's just up to me to help somebody get somewhere that they need healing. Vocabulary, validating somebody, using the terminology back to them. Yes, you have been hurt. You're a victim. You're being hurt right now. And sometimes people, it gives them a sense of empowerment and support, definitely.
Yeah, we give survivors of vocabulary. You know, we would call that abuse. We would call it domestic violence. Can't we call it sin? We can, but we need to We're giving you permission to call that abuse, so you can say that's abuse. Because most people don't know. I guess that's just what a wife puts up with. No, that's not. That's abuse. The verse in Proverbs 3, it's actually mentioned two other times by James and Peter. God gives grace to the humiliated. God opposes the proud, gives grace to the humiliated. The big issue I get with faith leaders is, well, we're supposed to support the offender. We give grace to the humiliated first. That's what the Hebrew word means, the victim. What's happening is we're supporting the offender and the victim feels uncared for in churches. We give grace to the victim, the survivor, the one who's humiliated. Well, doesn't the offender deserve grace? Sure, but they should go to better intervention. They should go through repentance, which means validating your victim. Leave your gift at the altar, go make it right. So we do that as well. Teach males to respect females. That's the bigger one as well. How do we respect women? We feel very comfortable about East County here and how that's cultivated. A lot of churches, that's not the case, but those are things we can do. I think we're... So I'm going to pass on... Follow us on Instagram and Facebook. Yeah. What a good way to end a Sunday school class. Please follow us.
And if you ever need... You can always contact us with any of it. So.
And then the final one, you're going... There's your sermon code. When Kevin gets the sermon, go on there.
You get to rate Kevin today.
No. I promise them they're not getting raped. We want to hear your thoughts on this, so do that afterwards.
All right.
Thank you for your time. Okay. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram, please. We didn't say it.